Transfiguration was as much a mental discipline as a magical one, which was why they spent time transforming things into familiar objects like needles and matches and frogs. Everyone knew what a teacup looked like, but it was also why no two teacups appeared exactly the same. Hermione's transfigurations were always beautiful, delicately wrought and elegantly decorated. It wasn't enough for her to change a toadstool into a toad. It had to be a specific species of toad, whereas Harry and Ron were satisfied if it had four limbs, two eyes, and croaked. It was a thornier issue to remove transfiguration spell if one wasn't certain what the original object had been. The pile of dust on the desk, had it been parchment or ink, a quill or a candle? Harry wanted to be certain he knew what he was doing before he pointed his wand at any of the piles of dust and inadvertently destroyed the very things Snape wanted him to have. Harry found McGonagall in the headmaster's office and looked around as he stepped through the door. Instead of the pleasant jumble of magical instruments that were as much a part of the office as the portraits of the former heads of Hogwarts, he found a well-ordered desk, somewhat Spartan by Dumbledore's standards, but much in keeping with McGonagall's astringent personality. McGonagall's head came up in surprise as Harry approached the desk. Her eyes narrowed for a moment, her head tilted thoughtfully. "How did you get in, Mr. Potter?" Harry glanced over his shoulder at the door as he mentally retraced his steps. "I touched the gargoyle with my wand, same as I've done all summer." It occurred to him that it shouldn't be possible, but Harry discovered that Snape's magic was subtle, masterful, nearly a work of art. "I see." A trace of a smile softened the lines of McGonagall's face. "And the purpose for your visit?" Harry described what he'd found in Snape's rooms and told of the night Dumbledore had introduced him to Professor Slughorn. "What I don't know," Harry said, "is how to undo a transfiguration without ruining the original object if I don't know what the object used to be." Instead of answering Harry's question, McGonagall handed him a slender book. "Read it, Mr. Potter. Then I'll answer any additional questions you might have." Harry sprawled out under an ancient oak tree, its heavy branches twisted and gnarled, the roots making the ground underneath where he lay lumpy and uneven. Still, it was more comfortable than being cooped up in the dungeons, and he lifted his face into the soft breeze, inhaling the scent of mown lawn and freshly turned earth. It was quiet out here. The outer walls had been repaired and the crews had moved to inside the castle to fix the stairways and corridors that had been damaged during the last battle. Whilst a part of Harry wished he was with them, the problems Snape had set proved to be more interesting than casting reparo after reparo and watching as gravel knitted itself into stone. Around him lay scattered half a dozen objects McGonagall had transfigured so Harry could practice the spells he was learning. It was delicate work, and he'd already destroyed a feather, a pincushion, and a handkerchief, but he whooped with joy when he managed to remove the transfiguration from a snail to reveal a thimble underneath. It was the last chapter in the book that caused Harry to sit up and take notice. The chapter dealt with illusions, spells that let people see what they expected to see instead of what was really there. It would make sense for Snape to hide his vast collection of pickled frog spleen and powdered moonstone bind of veil, rather than risk his stores to a clumsy transfiguration spell. And by the time Harry had made his way into Snape's laboratory, he hadn't expected to find a damn thing. Given his experience with cupboards, the presence of a spider was all but required. By the end of a week's hard study, Harry felt ready to return to Snape's quarters. Armed with the transfiguration textbook and his wand, he made his way to the dungeons, slipping easily through the gate and making his way with sure steps to Snape's door. He coaxed the door out of hiding, laid his palm on the wood, and whispered his name. Once inside, he doused the light, plunging the room into inky darkness. "Revelare incantatum," he said, flicking his wand decisively in the direction of the desk. The dusty surface glittered like ice, the pale blue light cold as frost. Harry repeated the spell several times. The bookcases and the mantelpiece sparkled with the same cool light, but the chair, sofa, and table did not. Harry started small. He worked on the places where the accumulation of dust was thinnest. He managed to transfigure Snape's red ink, but messed up the inkwell so that a bloody pool spread out over the scarred finish of the old wooden desk. As he watched the pool of ink grow wider, he could practically feel Snape breathing hot fumes of rage down his neck. He fixed the inkwell and siphoned the ink back into it, and his cheeks heated under the imagined scrutiny. Unfortunately, the spell picked up some of the dust as well, and Harry wondered what had been lost. By the end of the day, Harry had managed to restore the books to the empty bookshelves and the bits and bobs of an academic to Snape's desk, and he considered it time well spent. To his surprise, the desk wasn't spelled against him, and the drawers slid open easily. They were also empty, which explained Harry's lack of injury. After dinner, Harry sank into an overstuffed chair next to the fireplace in the Gryffindor common room, the Transfiguration book open on his lap. As he read through the final chapter for the seventh time, Ginny sat on the arm of his chair and started playing with his hair. "Knock it off, I'm trying to read," Harry said irritably. He swatted at her hand and shifted away from her, shooting her a withering glance as he did so. Ginny pressed her lips into a thin line. "I'm beginning to think you'd rather not have me for your girlfriend." She moved off the arm of the chair and sat on the table in front of him. "What's going on? You've been... it's like I don't even exist." Harry removed his glasses and rubbed his eyes as he smiled half-heartedly. "It's not that," he said. "This is a lot harder than I thought it would be. I've not even started on the potion yet. I finally got into Snape's rooms last week, and he's transfigured or disguised everything as dust and dirt. So I've had to learn how to undo the spells without ruining whatever he's transfigured. I still don't even know how to get rid of the gate, and I've got to finish all this before school starts again and Ron and I move to London. Your birthday's in 2 days, and Mum expects you at the Burrow." Ginny reached out and touched Harry on the knee when he blinked. "Yeah, it's the end of July already." She gave a little huff and shook her head. "I should have known you'd have forgotten." "I didn't forget," Harry protested. "I just didn't know it was that soon." The entire month of July had slipped by without notice, and Harry felt the press of panic against his chest. He collapsed into the chair and watched the play of firelight in the deep red of Ginny's hair. "I've been a crap boyfriend," he said. "You never do anything halfway," Ginny replied with a bit of a smile. "That's one of the things I like best about you." She stood over him and leaned over to give him a kiss, which Harry returned with more eagerness than he felt. "Come with me to Quidditch, please." Deciding that there were worse ways to spend an evening, Harry agreed. On the first day of August, Harry started sleeping in Snape's rooms. By the end of the first week of August, Harry had turned Snape's rooms into a very cosy nest for himself. He started his unveiling project with the tiny bathroom, discovering nothing more than a few half-empty potion phials, a couple of threadbare towels and other assorted linens. The wardrobe held several worn teaching robes, a stained white shirt and, inexplicably, a short red satin dressing gown. "It couldn't possibly be Snape's," was Harry's first thought, as he pulled it out and ran the silky fabric through his fingers. It flew in the face of everything he thought he knew about the man. But the aroma that clung to it wasn't the soft, sweet smell Harry associated with women. It was musky, almost smoky, tangy and nearly as bitter as Snape himself. He set it carefully back inside the wardrobe, his thoughts too jumbled to make any sense of them, and allowed his feet to carry him to the sitting room to work in there for a while. It was more challenging to remove the spells in Snape's laboratory, but at the end of a grueling night's work, Harry discovered that the shelves in the laboratory were laden with bottles and jars filled with ingredients, though he thought some of them might be spoilt. The newt's eyes were cloudy and slimy, and Harry was very nearly sick when he opened it. It had taken over an hour to get the smell out. His days were spent in Greenhouse 3 or in the Forbidden Forest, gathering the ingredients he needed for Amortentia. It wasn't enough to know that he needed to select jasmine petals under a full moon. He also needed to know there was a difference between whispering jasmine, a magical plant, and night-blooming jasmine, the muggle variety. That he needed to harvest the leaves from weeping primrose without making it burst into tears. That the aster used in Amortentia was most potent when grown near daisies. On the first full moon following his birthday, Harry pulled on his invisibility cloak and stepped through the gate barring the way into the dungeons towards the Forbidden Forest. On his arm he carried a woven basket, and in his pocket was a silver knife he'd found in one of the cupboards in Snape's laboratory. His wand was clutched tightly in his hand. As the lights from the castle faded and Harry stepped under the eaves of the forest, he saw the glowing tip of his wand quivering, and he swallowed heavily, the bitter taste of fear drying the inside of his mouth. The further he wandered into the forest, the harder it was to convince himself that a Death Eater wasn't behind every rustle of leaves, that a necromantula with a grudge wasn't dogging his every step. Yet Snape had made a similar journey every time he was summoned, had tamped down the heart-stopping terror of discovery to deliver misinformation to Voldemort time and time again. The closer Harry came to the clearing, it would always be capitalised in his head, the more he found himself wishing he had the Resurrection Stone so he could call up Snape and try to have a conversation with him. The thought made him equally happy he'd lost it, and it wasn't until he stepped into the open that his fear overwhelmed him. Hagrid had been tied up over there. Voldemort and his Death Eaters had been out under that tree. Harry had stepped out from between those two saplings, alone and terrified. Quicker and easier than falling asleep. Fred, Colin, Lupin and Tonks, Sirius, Dumbledore falling, Snape lying in a pool of his own blood, bleeding memories. His death had been neither quick nor easy. Guilt choked him and crushing grief wrapped iron bands around his chest. "I'm sorry," he blurted before he was blindsided by tears. After some time had passed, he wiped his eyes and picked up the basket he hadn't realised he'd dropped, then walked the rest of the way through the clearing, keeping his eyes averted, inordinately relieved no one had been around to witness him falling apart. He walked along the trail where he and Draco had come across the murdered unicorn, and found himself thinking about the last time he'd seen him, huddled up with his parents after the battle had ended. Harry tried to muster up some sympathy for Draco, but he found himself falling short. If Dumbledore had been right, it was our choices that defined us, then Draco had chosen to be a prat. Still, Harry was a bit surprised to discover he could no longer muster up the energy necessary to loathe him properly. Life, he'd learnt, was too short to waste time on people who meant nothing to him. The moon was rising, and by the time Harry found the pasture where the unicorns grazed, it appeared no longer than a canut in the sky. A fallen tree was covered with vines, and Harry crouched down to study it for a moment. It was some sort of petunia, which made him snort as he harvested flowers. When he stood, he noticed some burrs clinging to his jeans, plucked those off to add to his basket, certain there'd be some use for them. He found a clutch of quail eggs and tucked them in around the flowers. Took another 20 minutes of crawling on his knees to find what Harry was searching for. A type of plant called sparkling ambrosia, which the unicorns devoured much in the way thestrals ate meat. The edges of the leaves were rimmed in tiny dots of red spell light, and Harry made certain not to touch them as he took each leaf by the stem and severed it as gently as he could. It occurred to him as he crept through the meadow, clipping berries here, stripping bark there, that Snape must have spent many a night out here doing much the same thing, and Harry felt the stirrings of a sort of kinship with a man he once thought he'd known as well as the back of his own hand. Harry glanced at his hand, the "I must not tell lies," shining faintly in the moonlight, and chuckled a bit. "Turns out I don't know the back of my hand nearly as well as I thought," he said in a voice as soft as the moonlight. Harry returned to the castle, his basket laden with flora and fauna that had some use in potions, and he began the work of cleaning and preserving everything he'd collected. It was delicate work. At one point Harry would have called it tedious, and he didn't finish until well after dawn. But when he looked at his little row of bottles and jars, all carefully labelled and under the proper stasis spells, he felt quite pleased with himself. He liked to think Snape would have merely rolled his eyes and compared his efforts to that of a moderately intelligent orangutan. Snape's way of indicating Harry's work was an acceptable level. With that thought in mind, Harry crawled into Snape's bed and fell asleep. Amortentia was a tricky potion to brew. There were 39 separate steps and a list of ingredients as long as Harry's arm, most of which required additional preparation once he'd taken them down from Snape's stores. He had to crush the moonstone into a fine powder. The dove hearts had to be minced. Pollen had to be cleaned off the jasmine blossoms before he could crush them. After reading through the recipe, Harry collected parchment and quill from Snape's desk and began to outline the potion. He found amongst Snape's books a journal that compared several different love potions, Amortentia included, and cheered aloud when he saw that Snape had annotated each article. It was almost like having his half-blood prince back, and Harry's confidence rose accordingly. It took Harry 5 days and 3 tries before he managed to brew something he thought would pass muster with Snape, but at long last the steam rose in lazy spirals over a cauldron filled with shimmering potion. Harry leant over and inhaled deeply. The familiar scent of treacle tart and broomstick polish rushed to fill his head, But the flowery smell he remembered from Slughorn's class had become something sharp and acrid, yet sweet, like smoke from a slow fire. The memory niggled, but he couldn't place it. It was familiar, and Harry breathed deeply before sitting back. "All right, that's done," Harry said aloud. "But what am I going to use it for?" He bottled the potion carefully and set the labelled files on a shelf before cleaning his workspace, his brain working at a rate Hermione would be proud of. When Snape's laboratory was put back together again, Harry pulled out the brief letter Snape had left for him and read it again. "Amongst my belongings you will find a few precious keepsakes." But Harry hadn't found anything he'd call a keepsake. Deciding he could tolerate a bit of company, Harry went up to the Great Hall to join the others for dinner. The suits of armour had been repaired in the 2 weeks since he'd taken up residence in Snape's room. The portraits had been rehung. The great staircase gleamed, though none of the smaller staircases were moving yet. It appeared Hogwarts would reopen on time, provided Harry had managed to remove the barrier to the dungeons. As Harry slipped into his usual seat, he glanced up to find Ron gazing at him, his eyes cool. "Decided to join us, have you?" Harry froze. His eyes darted between Ron and Ginny, and he squirmed under their disapproval. "You don't understand. Snape left this for me to do, and he made it so that I can't have help. I have to find whatever it is I'm searching for, so maybe I'll have a clue how to open the gate." "You realise we start aura training in 3 weeks, right? That Hogwarts opens in a fortnight or so. We haven't bought books yet. We don't have a place to live. Been hours for you, but hardly anyone has seen you since your birthday." Ron's tone was steely, and Harry felt a surge of guilt. "You've barely spent any time with Ginny." Appetite vanished. Harry stared at his empty plate before saying anything. "We can go to Diagon Alley on Saturday, right? Pick up the things we need?" Ron's expression didn't soften as he shook his head. "Hermione's coming back on Saturday. I'm spending the day with her." He paused. "Alone." Harry's cheeks burnt, and he kept his eyes averted. "Right, say hello for me." He snatched a piece of bread from the nearby basket and rose to his feet. Dark circles smudged his eyes, and his hair was more messy than usual. He stole an exhausted glance at Ginny. "The potion's done," he said quietly. "I finished it about half an hour ago, but I don't know what I'm to do with it. I've not found my mum's things yet either." He turned and trudged back through the Great Hall. Just as he reached the doors, he heard, "Harry, wait." He turned to see Ron running through the hall. "It's like this. Snape said I couldn't help, but bloody hell, I'm not about to touch that gate again, and I reckon he meant it. But that's not the same thing as keeping everything a secret." Ron's eyes searched Harry's face. "You're hungry and you're knackered. Come back to the table and tell us what you've been working on and where you're stuck. Maybe Ginny and I can think of something you've not thought of yet." A tired smile lit up Harry's face, and he was filled with relief as he walked back with Ron. As he filled his plate, he went through everything he'd learnt over the course of the summer. The detection spells, dismantling protective charms, removing transfiguration spells. He told them about the mind-numbing hours spent cataloguing Snape's belongings. He even told them about his trip into the Forbidden Forest, omitting only the part about the clearing. Amortentia is the key. But the key to what? "Harry," Ginny said, finally speaking up, "did you save any of your first attempts at brewing Amortentia? Snape said he'd know if you'd found someone else to brew it for you." Her brow furrowed. "I mean, his spells would know." "Can you imagine being that good at magic?" It was a rhetorical question, but a note of wistfulness entered Harry's voice. He could have learnt so much if he hadn't been so busy keeping his hatred alive. "But no, I didn't. The first potion was... well, Neville could have done better." Ginny laughed, a bright, sparkling sound that raised Harry's spirits. "His potions are rather legendary," she said. She watched with approval as Harry refilled his plate and started on seconds. "And the second attempt?" "Looked a bit like a steaming mud bath," Harry said. "It was the right colour, but wrong consistency and the steam didn't spiral. This one, though, the corkscrews are a bit wobbly and it's not quite as shiny as the draft Slughorn showed us, but it's definitely recognisable as Amortentia." "Let's set aside the potion for now," Ron said. "You said you hadn't found anything of your mum's. Where have you looked?" Harry enumerated them. "There's not much left in the dungeons and nothing at all in the headmaster's tower. I've not packed up his lab yet, but trust me, he didn't think he'd keep anything in there that didn't have to do with potions. I don't know Snape, but I keep things that are important to me locked in my school trunk or in my bedroom back at the Burrow," Ginny said. Where do you keep the things you want to save? When Harry stayed at the Dursleys, he had kept anything he didn't want destroyed underneath the floorboards in his bedroom. But the floors in Snape's quarters were stone. "Haven't seen a trunk anywhere," he said slowly. "I checked the wardrobe, but there are only a few old teaching robes in it." Harry made no mention of the scarlet dressing gown and the few restless nights that came along with it. That was one secret he was determined to keep. "Were there any drawers in it?" Ron asked. "What about his bedside table?" Ginny asked at the same time. They shared a look and grinned. "And under the bed," she added. "There's no bedside table." It was inconceivable to Harry how Snape had managed without one. Surely Snape had read in bed. With all those books, how could he not have done? "Yeah, there are drawers in the wardrobe, but they're empty. I didn't look under the bed, though." "Are you sure they're empty?" Ron asked. He was really good at hiding things." Harry blinked. "Well," he said, "I didn't see any dust in them." Ginny smiled over her teacup. "Did you see what you were expecting to see?" The first thing Harry did upon his return to Snape's bedroom was check the wardrobe for enchantments. The top drawer was indeed empty. The bottom drawer was not, and it took Harry over an hour of hard work to break through the spells hiding its contents. When he'd finished, though, he wished he'd left well enough alone. He slumped down on the edge of the bed, hands buried in stifling black fabric, a pale mask staring lifelessly up at him. For one brief, insane moment, Harry thought about trying it on, but his psyche screamed in horror at the idea, and he felt bile rising up in his throat. He carried the robes into the sitting room with shaking hands and laid them carefully in the fireplace, the mask turned face down on top of them. Incendio. Harry sat quietly and watched them burn. He rolled out of bed the next morning after a night filled with terrifying dreams, his thoughts muddled and his stomach still churning. Snape had been a Death Eater. Somehow, in romanticising his past, Harry had allowed himself to forget that. "But he left after Voldemort murdered your parents," a little voice whispered in the back of his mind. One thing had been clear. Whatever mistakes Snape had made in his past, he had sincerely regretted each and every one. "And it's not like you're exactly blameless," the haunting voice continued. He stumbled his way into the small bathroom and tried to shower away the darkness of his thoughts. After another raid on the kitchens for breakfast, Harry returned to Snape's bedroom and began a careful inspection. With a wave of his wand, he plunged the room into darkness and began crawling along the baseboards, casting small revealing spells as he went. The green, or blue, or purple, or red, sparkles showed up much better in the dark, and Harry spelled a small X onto the wall whenever he found magical residue. Harry's knees ached by the time he'd finished, but discovering a bedside table, a low bookcase, and Snape's old school trunk made the pain worthwhile. He sat cross-legged on a thick rug transfigured from Snape's pillow and examined the contents of the bookcase first. Back issues of a number of potions journals stood in rigid lines along both shelves, but if they're arranged in any particular order, Harry couldn't tell what it was. He pulled one at random and flipped it open before turning his head in the direction of the sitting room, a frown of confusion puckering his forehead. He was certain he'd seen this issue when writing down the titles of every publication Snape owned. The same held true for every issue, and it wasn't until Harry started skimming over the table of contents that he realised that Snape had an article published in every single one. He went back to the beginning of the collection and read more carefully, finding scathing letters to the editors so Snape-like that Harry imagined he felt wet spittle moistening his cheek. He choked out a laugh as he read, impressed with Snape's ability to pile on insult after insult without repeating a word or phrase, and by the time he finished reading the third such letter, the words were blurring on the page. He removed his glasses and scrubbed at his eyes, making a note to keep these journals for himself. The contents of the bedside table taught Harry more about Snape than he ever wanted to know. In addition to the ordinary things, scraps of parchment, old quills, several books and a sealed file of hangover remedy, he also found evidence that Snape had a well-rounded private life. Harry had had no expectations when he opened the drawer, but his jaw had dropped to his knees at a single glance inside. The presence of a magazine wasn't unusual. Seamus's collection was legendary. Finding a thing that looked like a very lifelike replica of a man's penis took Harry by surprise and his hand shook as he picked it up. To his admittedly unpracticed eye, The rubbery prick appeared well used, and Harry couldn't stop the low rise of colour that tinted his cheeks. His stomach did a slow roll. His fingers were icy. Heat pooled in strange places. Harry put the item aside and pointedly ignored it whilst he continued his exploration. A cursory inspection of the magazine, Crossed Wands, revealed that it had absolutely nothing to do with potions, despite the photograph on the cover with two attractive men sitting in a cauldron. One of them ran a slow eye over Harry's body, and Harry knew, just knew, the man had seen him turn bright red before he'd managed to shove the magazine back into the drawer. Harry's eyes flashed the wardrobe. Perhaps the crimson dressing gown wasn't as mysterious as he had believed. Imagination-fueled images clung to Harry's retinas, strong as cobwebs and no easier to remove. His skin prickled and fire filled his veins. Harry spent the next few hours prowling round the dungeons, trying to work off the strange energy coursing through him. He swept the potions classroom and dusted the students' doors, after making certain it was real dust, as he ignored the thoughts parading through his skull with all the subtlety of a herd of elephants. And when Harry dreamt of Snape that night, Snape laughed at him. If Harry had thought the desk in the headmaster's office was a nightmare, then the most frightening magical creature he'd ever encountered was a pygmy puff. Snape's trunk was layered with more spells than Harry had ever heard of, and as he tried to untangle them, he became more and more convinced he was going about this the wrong way. He dragged it out into the sitting room and considered his options as he sat beside the fire. Unless Harry missed his guess, Snape had used dozens of standard protective spells, some defensive spells, and at least three curses. And those were just the spells Harry could identify. There was other magic lurking on that trunk, dark and dangerous, twisting around the sides of it like venomous tentacula in a bed of devil's snare. He couldn't even touch his wand to the keyhole without setting off a shower of sparks. The trunk had even growled at him. Twice. Harry perched on the edge of the chair, his elbows resting on his knees, his wand dangling between his fingers as he stared into the flames. There must have been a reason Snape protected that trunk so carefully. "You didn't trust me," Harry thought suddenly, sitting bolt upright. "You thought I'd find a way to get Ron and Hermione to help me." He launched himself from the chair and began to pace. Harry could hardly blame him. Amongst the many recurring themes woven through Snape's endless litany of insults were Harry's laziness and penchant for breaking rules. Naturally, Snape had made damn certain Harry could do neither, not if he wanted to gain access to those things Snape considered to be most valuable. "So which is it? Am I to break your rules or find a way to dismantle your fucking spells?" Even dead, Snape still managed to ignite Harry's temper. He stormed into the laboratory and snatched up one of Snape's silver knives, the blade wickedly sharp. On impulse, he grabbed one of the phials of Amor Tincture he'd brewed so carefully and shoved it into the pocket of his jeans as well. Standing over the trunk, he scored a line across his hand with the knife, hissing as the blade bit into his skin. The pain sliced through his anger and he watched in grim satisfaction as the blood welled in his palm. He tossed the knife onto the sofa nearby, pointed his wand at the trunk and drew a steadying breath as he turned his hand over. Blood, crimson and hot, spilled drop by drop onto the lid, where it sizzled and smoked as if landing on a hot skillet. Sparks danced along the edges of the trunk as he watched in horror, but Harry could think of no spell to put them out. Smoke began to rise, its tendrils wafting out to circle around Harry's head. "Aguamenti!" he shouted, brandishing his wand, but the water sprayed everywhere except on the trunk itself. Out of ideas and in desperation, Harry upended the phial of potion onto the trunk where it absorbed the charred remains of his blood as it hissed and spat like a drowned cat. The smoke vanished. The sparks died. Water still ran down the walls, but Harry ignored it as he crouched down in front of the trunk, his eyes wide. He cast a low-level revealing spell but found no trace of magic. Reaching out with an unsteady hand, Harry pressed on the latch and heard a distinctive click. Heart lodged firmly in his throat, he scrambled onto his knees and lifted the lid. In the centre of a thick Gryffindor scarf, against broad stripes of red and gold, lay a folded square of parchment with Harry Potter scrawled across it in a familiar, spiky hand. He opened it, tilted the note towards the fire and read, "Charms. Exceeds expectations. Defence against the dark arts. Outstanding. Herbology. acceptable. Potions exceeds expectations. Transfiguration, outstanding. Well done, Potter. Severus Snape. P.S. Touch the bars in the following order. 1, 3, 2, 5, 4, 7, 6. Pour 5 drops of the potion onto the center crossbar and speak the name you undoubtedly uttered before your own. The note was going in Harry's trunk alongside his invisibility cloak and the last shard from Sirius's mirror, so Harry could save the sense of accomplishment reading Snape's note gave him. He would take these marks over any assigned by the Wizarding Examinations Authority any day. He lifted out the old-fashioned scarf, a broad smile curving his lips, and draped it across his shoulders as he imagined Snape and his mum trading scarves once they'd finished their first year at Hogwarts. He knew better than to think they'd ever been seen in public with a scarf from a rival house, but Snape would have begged and his mum would have relented, if only to dispel a little of the gloom that clung to Snape like a Dementor's cloak. Underneath the scarf, Harry found a thick scroll of heavy vellum. It was a simple thing that declared Severus Snape had passed the examinations for Potions Master and had been admitted to the most extraordinary society of potioneers with first-class honours, but it was pristine and had been protected with a preservation spell. The signature at the bottom was illegible, but it was dated 17th of June, 1981. Snape had been young then. Under the scroll was a thick sheet of parchment. The cover page proclaimed it to be Snape's thesis, and one Stir Widdershins submitted as part of his mastery. The second page had 3 signatures. The word extraordinary was printed next to one in the middle. Harry read the abstract and was hopelessly lost by the end of the second sentence. As far as Harry could tell, Snape had analysed the effects of metallurgy on brewing potions, stating that the type of cauldron, knife, scales, etc., played as much a part in the potency of potions as did the direction of the stirring. It was over Harry's head, but he thought Hermione would enjoy it. He found a collection of letters between Snape and several other potioneers, waging verbal warfare over the use of lionfish spines in restorative potions. There was a heavily marked-up copy of the first article Snape had submitted to Cauldron's Quarterly. There was, as promised, an essay Snape and Harry's mother had submitted for Muggle studies in their third year, explaining the point of television. Harry hit the motherlode underneath all the potions-related material. The Evanses had moved after his mum's first year, and Lily had written to Snape during their summers apart. Snape had saved every one of her letters. "She won't even speak with me, Sev. My own sister hates me." Harry could imagine the blistering diatribe Snape must have sent back, since his mum stopped writing about Petunia not long after. Instead, her correspondence was filled on advice on how to manage Snape's increasingly turbulent relationship with his father. "Sev, I know you're doing your best, but I've already worked it out with Mum and Dad. I know you don't get on with Petunia, who does these days, but I hate seeing you so unhappy. Please promise me that if it happens again, you'll come to Spelthorn. I'll have a train ticket waiting at the station." Harry devoured the letters and watched their friendship crumble as they grew apart. Over the years, his mum grew distant and more cautious, and Harry suspected that Snape clung that much tighter to the only bright spot he had in his life. His heart ached for both of them, knowing he'd experienced the same ebb and flow in his friendship with Ron, and they'd been in the same house. But through her letters he knew her better now, and he owed Snape a debt of gratitude that could never be repaid. The last envelope contained not a letter, but dozens of photographs, some whole, some with others torn out. Most of them were Muggle, and in black and white, but there were a few faded colour pictures and even fewer wizarding ones. He picked one up and his eyes filled as his mother gazed at him in curiosity and gave him a tentative wave. In another, Snape stepped in front of her and made a not too subtle gesture with his wand. They hadn't known him then, he hadn't been born yet, and their photographic selves had no knowledge of him. But Lily had been friendly, and Snape had been protective, and Harry missed both of them terribly. Harry took a break then, stealing off for some food and some time with his thoughts. The downside of revisiting Snape's childhood and adolescence was that it came hand in hand with his mother's, which inevitably led to his father and to Sirius. To Remus and Tonks, Fred, Colin Creevy, whom Harry had tolerated rather than liked, Cedric Diggory, Dumbledore. After an hour or so where Harry had worked through some of his anger and grief, he returned to the trunk. Under the layer of detritus that always seemed to build up, a hair ribbon, Some silly illustrated notes they'd passed back and forth in class. A Gringotts key. A letter from Regulus that started out as mushy as something Lavender Brown might pen and made Harry squirm. Lay a collection of journals, and when Harry drew one out at random, he knew instantly that this had been what Snape was protecting. Snape was a diarist. A quick count revealed 18 volumes, each of the highest quality Snape could afford. The first had been a gift from Snape's mother, evidenced by the note on the very first page. Dear Severus, each night before you go to bed, write something down about your day. It doesn't have to be much. Today was horrible, is enough. But you'll see at the end the steps of your journey. The spell I taught you will keep this safe. Do not worry about me. I will be fine. Love, Mum. The first entry read, Lily is in Gryffindor. I hate my life. But Snape had persisted and was parsimonious enough to write on every single line and use both sides of each page. It would take forever to read them all, but Harry vowed he would make time to do just that. Harry packed the battered old trunk carefully, leaving out only the marks on his N.E.W.T. Snape had awarded him. He restored a few of the protective enchantments, including one that would cause minor injury to anyone stupid enough to try to break into it, and stored it back in the corner by the wardrobe, where he'd found it. Harry left the gate standing when he left the dungeons. "I know how to open the gate," he said quietly to McGonagall once he'd been admitted to her office. "But before I take it down, I'd like to request a favour." Relief flooded McGonagall's face. The first day of September was just under a fortnight away. The house elves were punishing themselves daily, and Slughorn was becoming increasingly short-tempered over his inability to access his classrooms and office. "Of course, Harry, if I can." "I'd like to seal off Snape's rooms," he said, "so that I'm the only one who can get in. I'd like to keep his things in there the way he'd have left them. I know he had a house somewhere. I'd like to bring some of his belongings here as well. In exchange, I'll donate most of his books to the library. You know, things we don't already have here." McGonagall's eyebrows arched, and Harry knew his request had come as a surprise. "Permanently?" "I don't know yet," Harry replied, "but for a year or two at least, until I know best what to do with his things. Until I figure things out." It took a few minutes and a long glance at Dumbledore's portrait before McGonagall made up her mind. "I believe Hogwarts can manage without use of that space. Please do ask if you require assistance setting up the spells. Long-term enchantments can be a bit finicky, as I'm certain you've discovered." Harry's smile conveyed his thanks, and he excused himself to find Ron and Ginny, determined to salvage for himself some last bit of summer. He stepped onto the staircase that would eventually lead him to Gryffindor Tower, and Harry cheered as it swung out over the entrance hall. Much like himself, Hogwarts was reborn. September arrived before Harry was ready for it, and it was only because of Hermione's regentless cajolery that he and Ron were somewhat prepared for the start of aura training. Harry refused the stipend Kingsley Shacklebolt offered, but Ron used his to purchase uniforms, a second wand, and a stack of books tall enough to make Hermione salivate. Harry and Ron found a small flat in a wizarding building near King's Cross the Friday before they started their training. It had two small bedrooms, a smaller kitchen, and a long, narrow lounge that they turned into a dining area and sitting room. There was even a narrow balcony that overlooked a small park. It was only a short apparition hop away from the entrance to the Ministry of Magic, so Harry and Ron generally made it to work on time. It didn't take long before Harry and Ron settled into a routine. Ron fixed tea whilst Harry was in the shower. Harry cooked breakfast whilst Ron got clean. Ron did the dishes when they got home and Harry cooked dinner. Then, once the kitchen was clean, they would get out their books and read for the next day's lessons. By the end of the first week, Harry and Ron decided to share the larger of the two bedrooms and use the second room for guests. Nightmares were frequent and neither of them were sleeping well, especially with the unfamiliar sounds of a large city all around them. It wasn't quiet, not like it had been in the dungeons, and Harry knew the sound of Ron snoring from 6 years of sharing a dormitory with him. Every night, though, Harry made time to read from Snape's diaries. No matter how late it was, no matter how tired, he read, and related to, the struggles of an 11-year-old boy that never seemed to fit in. The only time he took a break from reading had been over the Christmas holes when he and Ron had gone to the Burrow. As much as he wanted to bring the current volume, Harry wasn't certain he could keep it from falling into the wrong hands. It had taken him over 6 months, nearly seven, to read the entire series, but by the time he had reached the final volume, he felt a strong bond of kinship with the man. They were mirrors of each other, a reflection of the choices they'd made, or that had been made for them. In Snape's life, the role of Draco Malfoy had been played by Sirius Black and James Potter. And by the time Harry had finished reading what he'd come to call the Lily Years, the blinders had fallen from his eyes. Yes, Harry knew there were two sides to every story, but his experience in Snape's pensieve tipped the balance in Snape's direction. The accounting in Snape's diary matched almost precisely the memory Harry had seen of Snape dangling upside down, displaying his worn, tattered underpants for the world to see. But that memory couldn't capture the towering rage that had sprung from Snape's utter humiliation at Sirius's hands. Nor had it shown the sniggering laughter and mocking asides that followed Snape from classroom to classroom, from dungeons to astronomy tower, until the day he stepped off the train at King's Cross Station. Nor had Snape's memories captured how lost he'd been when Harry's mum ended their friendship, how his self-loathing had sunk to new depths. Snape had done more than apologise. He'd cut himself off from those same friends she'd berated him for having. He tried to mind his tongue and his temper. He did everything he could think of to demonstrate his sincerity, but his mum had done worse than dig in her heels and refuse his entreaties. She'd ignored him, completely. It was Regulus who pulled him back into the fold. Regulus who paved Snape's way into Voldemort's inner circle. Regulus who had shown Snape kindness and consideration. Regulus who loved him. As much despite his brother as out of genuine caring. And when Sirius had engineered Snape's murder at Lupin's hand, it was Regulus who told Sirius that he'd kill him the minute Sirius set foot in Grimmauld Place. Snape hadn't loved him back. But when Regulus disappeared, Snape had been heartsick. He poured himself into his studies, used his brewing as an excuse to escape the worst of the Death Eater raids, and tried to ignore the terror and ugliness that surrounded him. To Harry's surprise, it wasn't his parents' murder that set Snape's feet on the path to redemption. It was their marriage. Voldemort had taken great delight in Snape's pain when he informed Snape that Lily had married James Potter. Laughed when Snape's heart had been laid open. Mocked him for loving a woman he could never have, and wouldn't know what to do with if he'd won her. Neither had Snape known Lily was pregnant until he told Voldemort of the prophecy that governed Harry's life. He hadn't known he was endangering her until he saw the gleam in Voldemort's eye, felt the cold caress of evil behind that delighted smile. The whispered Lily had chilled his blood. Harry couldn't even blame Snape for choosing Lily over him. If he'd been in Snape's place, goaded into choosing between Hermione's child and her life, Harry couldn't say for certain that he would have made a different choice. Harry understood Snape's desperation and resented Dumbledore for putting the question to him. There was nothing in Snape's diaries that Harry hadn't felt at one point or another. He understood all too well how it felt to lose the first friend he'd ever made, even if it had turned out to be a temporary thing. He knew what it was like to have made a lifelong enemy before the Sorting Hat had ever touched his head. And sometimes, in the middle of the night when he was alone with his thoughts, Harry knew what it was like to love someone he wasn't attracted to, and never would be. It was a truth Harry couldn't face, much the way Snape couldn't face it either. The brewing years, those years between Lily's death and Harry's arrival at Hogwarts, were marked by relentless grief and aching loneliness. Harry empathised with how torn up Snape had been, knew in a way few others could, the searing anger and crushing guilt that took up permanent residence in the dark recesses of his heart. The year between Cedric's murder and Sirius's death was the blackest period of Harry's life, worse in many ways than the year of perpetual camping. But he'd had Ron and Hermione to lean on. Dumbledore left Snape to his own devices, allowing him to stew in bitterness and despair instead of leading him out of darkness. Many of the journal entries of that era surpassed Harry's understanding of them, filled as they were with the theoretical underpinnings of the mystical and arcane workings of potions. Rather, Harry sought wisdom through the methods Snape used to cope with feelings of inadequacy and depression. Snape had taken up the study of legilimency and occlumency, had worked hard with Flitwick to learn dueling spells and techniques, and every once in a while, once every blue moon or so, Dumbledore summoned him up to his office for a chat, that inevitably left Snape feeling worse about his lot in life. It was during the Harry years that Harry's perceptions underwent a sea change. It was upon viewing his actions through the lens of Snape's understanding of them, imperfect as it had been, that Harry understood why Snape saw him as thoughtless and reckless. Snape had despaired when Dumbledore made a gift of the invisibility cloak, which Harry had used confidently and with no understanding of its protections, or lack thereof. How in hell was Snape to keep Harry safe when he couldn't even see him? There was more to Snape's hatred than Harry appearing to be a carbon copy of James. Through the journals, Harry discovered that Snape truly feared for his safety and had tried to curb the worst of Harry's excesses, but Harry proved to be every bit as intractable as his father. Snape knew Harry had lied about hearing voices during his second year, and had invaded his mind enough to hear the frightening whispers, though he, like Dumbledore, had no idea what it meant. Harry had been surprised to discover that the teachers had put together the clues well enough to suspect Basilisk, but not much sooner than Hermione had done. It would have made very little difference in the end. Ginny still would have been captured. Harry would somehow still feel responsible and beholden to her. During Harry's third year, Snape had been terrified by Lupin's presence and spent much of it fighting an addiction to dreamless sleep. Whilst the potion had kept the worst of the nightmares at bay, it had done nothing to keep Snape's own formidable temper in check. As he waded through pages and pages of vitriol, though, Harry found himself wondering how he'd feel if he was forced to work alongside Draco Malfoy or Gregory Goyle. Worse, how Draco would feel if required to work with him. It was during Harry's fourth year that Snape came to find it impossible to loathe Harry and protect him as well. Antipathy gave way to a sort of grudging respect, though he was careful not to show any overt signs of consideration. To his students, to his Slytherins, to the world at large, he still had to demonstrate the same utter contempt for Harry, all the while being consumed by fear for his safety. "Dragons. Dragons as big as a fucking house. Malfoy's house. And Potter need only get past one and steal an egg. Think nothing of it, Severus. The boy will be fine. There are moments I'd like to rip out those twinkling eyeballs and shove them down his fucking throat. Dragons, with teeth as long as an elephant's prick, and that breathes fire. Has the old man forgotten that they're fucking hell on life expectancy? I'd rather stand before the Dark Lord in naught but women's knickers and a toothpick instead of my wand to protect me than try to approach a nesting dragon." It had only been Snape's superb occlumency skills that allowed him to view the first task with anything approaching equanimity. He'd spent most of that night crushing moonstone into powder until his hands stopped shaking. Everything changed the night the Dark Lord returned. Everything. Snape's entries became more guarded, every word chosen with care, as though even his innermost thoughts were being weighed with an eye towards the consequences of having them. He did not express remorse for having heard part of the prophecy that set his feet on a long and lonely path, not in writing, but curiosity about what he hadn't heard gnawed at him more than it ever had done before. He didn't want to know, didn't want to be vulnerable to the Dark Lord's whims, of hiding knowledge he shouldn't possess behind a thin veil of obfuscation. Ignorance wasn't bliss. It was protection. The occlumency lessons were no better for Snape than they had been for Harry. Perhaps if he'd done the readings, Harry would have known that the best way to learn occlumency was by learning guided legitimacy first. Harry shuddered at the memories that Snape must have carried in his head that year and couldn't blame the man for not allowing Harry to stampede recklessly through them. Forced to start in the middle with a boy he neither liked nor trusted, it was to be expected they would fail so spectacularly. Some of Snape's entries confused him. How is it possible he does not know? It appears he has a type. Lithe, dark, relatively brainless, much like my own. In his defence, defending him now, Severus, that's how it begins, that's how it always begins. You turned your back on the mere suggestion, no matter how often Lily pointed it out to you, for all the good it did you. The spots are set, and no matter how much you wept over her, the Dark Lord was right about you. I do not wish to feel 15 again. The pensive incident read nothing like Harry expected. It started out the way he anticipated. My pensive. The insolent whelp was in my pensive. Naturally, being a Potter means he hasn't respect for anyone other than himself. Thought he was entitled to my memories, the speck-eyed bastard. How like his father he is. Nearly as bad as his loathsome dog-father. But once Snape had filled a page describing the many and varied indignities he would visit on Sirius if given half a chance, he ended with something that left Harry in a daze. No, Lily, I will not deny it. Not now, 20 years later. Yes, James was beautiful. Yes, I would have buggered him senseless, sucked him dry, tasted every inch of his skin if given a ghost of a chance. There, are you happy now? I was 15 fucking years old, and my father would have beaten me bloody had he any idea his son was a fucking ponce. I had no hope. Lupin was too busy baring his throat to Black to rein the mongrel in. Pettigrew incited Black to new levels of idiocy at every opportunity, and James was always with them. I've seen your temper, Lily. You'd have done no better had your Frankie been a witness to a similar humiliation. I can only hope your spawn overlooked the finer details. Snape had fancied his father. Harry went back to the entries written around that time, searching for any indication that Snape felt anything but intense loathing for his dad, but found little beyond vague references to some dreams Snape refused to acknowledge. Dreams of the sort with which Harry was becoming all too familiar. Sleep refused to come, and Harry supposed he was grateful for the respite. He was too young to want second chances, but he wanted, no, needed, a chance to speak with Snape. To apologise, he told himself firmly. Nothing more than that. They were too different to become friends. The animosity ran too deep for that. "But you're just like him," supplied the tiny voice who tangled Harry's thoughts in razor wire, slicing his psyche wide open, exposing ideas best kept hidden. "And what you want isn't friendship." Scowling, Harry punched his pillow and flopped down onto his side to stare at the wall until dawn. Sixth year had been complicated, but it wasn't until Harry read the journals from that year that he had the smallest inkling about the horrors of Snape's situation, of the dangers Snape faced. "Here, Severus, I need you to develop some rapport with Draco, keep your unbreakable vow to Narcissa, appear to kill me in cold blood to further your credibility with the Dark Lord, and, oh, lest we forget, inform Potter that he must die at the Dark Lord's hand now that he no longer believes a single word that comes out of your mouth." If Harry were to go by what he were reading, it was almost as if there were three Harrys in Snape's life. The brash, reckless Gryffindor who did whatever he damned well pleased without thought to the consequences. The Chosen One, who was burdened by prophecy and isolated because of it. And the Harry Snape hated as much out of habit as genuine dislike. It was on the occasions when Snape's entries took on a conversational tone, when he wrote directly to Lily, that Harry went from being Potter, always used as an epithet, to Lily's son or your son, when Snape was worked up about something. It was as if Harry had stepped out of James's shadow and began to exist as a person in his own right. Though Harry had been pants at non-verbal spells, and still was if aura training was any indication, he had a gift for defensive magic, and Snape recognised that. Underneath the sarcasm lay a grudging respect, if one turned the journal sideways and squinted. Snape's journals weren't an endless exposition on all things Harry Potter. They're a doorway into the life of a potions master, much as the brewing years had been. Of a teacher. Of a man who was weary to the bone and hungered for solitude, yet ached from loneliness. Who had no patience for human frailties because he'd been crippled by them. Here, in these pages, the half-blood prince still lived, with the same keen intellect, the same dry wit, the same scathing observations that marked every single exchange Harry had ever had with the man. Harry learnt that Snape despised Aubergine, thought Draco a bigger dunderhead than Harry, felt guilty about the Longbottoms, and had schemed with Flitwick and McGonagall against Umbridge in small yet delightfully wicked ways. Snape had also embarked on several relationships, mostly for the sex, and Harry gave some thought to tearing those pages out. The realisation he was jealous of a dead man's lovers did not sit well. It took Harry almost a month to pick up the journals again after that, and, to his chagrin, even Ron noticed he'd stopped reading them. "Have you finished them, then?" Harry looked up from the treatise on the reasonable restriction of underage sorcery and stretched. Merlin, the readings they had to do for their training lessons, was almost as dull as anything Binns had ever assigned. He glanced at the chapter and shook his head. "No, I've still got another 3 or 4 pages to go." "Not with that," Ron said. "With Snape's books." "Not yet." Harry took off his glasses and rubbed his eyes. "Haven't been able to bring myself to read about that night." He slipped his glasses back on and gazed at Ron, who was sprawled out on their sofa in their tiny sitting room. "Do you find it odd I'm reading them?" Ron gave Harry a speculative look. "Not really. You knew Sirius and your parents, your mum especially. And he was your half-blood prince, wasn't he?" "He wasn't my half-blood prince," Harry muttered. Ron arched an eyebrow. "You go on telling yourself that. Look, you and Snape have a history, but it's not like him and his Slytherins. It's you, your dad and your mum and you-know-who and Dumbledore and the whole bloody world, all rolled up in this great package, and there's no way to pull it apart and look at each one of you by yourself, as yourselves." He took a deep breath and tilted his head, studying Harry for a moment. "If he had lived," he continued quietly, I'm not certain you'd be going out with Ginny." The room grew very quiet. Harry was certain it was because his heart had stopped, though he wasn't certain why the blood was still rushing through his ears. "What do you mean by that?" he asked after a long minute. Ron said something under his breath that Harry couldn't hear and shook his head. "Nothing. Doesn't matter. Say, have you finished that essay Dawlish wants on the surveillance of unplottable buildings?" Harry gave Ron a crooked smile, feeling strangely light-headed all of a sudden. "Why, so you can copy from it?" Ron flashed Harry two fingers and they both went back to their studies. But that night, Harry picked up the journal again and started reading. There was a long break between the last entry before Dumbledore's death and the first entry afterwards. Snape hadn't returned to Hogwarts until the fall of the Ministry, and if he'd kept any sort of record during that time, which Harry thought he must have done, Harry didn't know where it was hidden. But as he read, Harry began to suspect Dumbledore would know. The portraits had not been idle during Snape's year as headmaster. Dumbledore guided his steps as much as a charmed portrait could, and Phineas Nigellus had proved to be an invaluable source of information. If Hermione had any idea how much Snape learnt through Phineas's observations and interrogations, even as a portrait Phineas was every bit as cantankerous as Snape, she would have set the picture on fire. Somehow, though, Snape had managed to have a replica of the sword of Gryffindor made to pass along to Bellatrix Lestrange, right under the noses of the Carrows. He kept McGonagall and Flitwick off balance, and they remained convinced that Snape was firmly in the Death Eater camp, yet managed to keep the younger students from harm and the DA from being discovered. "And to think I thought you were a coward," Harry muttered, as he turned off the lights. He didn't hear Ron sigh. It wasn't the goings-on at Hogwarts that caught Harry's attention. Between dancing attendance on Voldemort and running the school in such a manner that some learning was taking place, Snape was brewing potions to cure every malady under the sun, including extreme blood loss and poisoning by all manners of dark creatures. There were vague references to renovations Snape needed to make at some cottage near a wood, and long rants involving Madame Pomfrey and some house elf named Einby. It also appeared that Snape was developing some rather complex portkey charms that intrigued Harry enough to ask John Savage, head of the Department of Security, about their use. If Harry was reading it right, Snape was trying to tie the activation of a portkey to his vital signs. If Snape stopped breathing, or his heart gave out, or his blood pressure dropped precipitously, his body would be transported to this mysterious cottage he'd mentioned. "And you're clever enough to manage it," Harry whispered. "I will take the modified portkey when I deliver the sword. Given Potter's unwillingness to stop and think, much less listen, I have little hope of surviving an encounter with him with my limbs, much less my dignity, intact. I can only pray the boy refrains from using the unforgivables, or this will go badly wrong. I still believe using the Patronus is the better plan, though Dumbledore continues to put faith in Potter's ability to see reason. After 6 years, I have yet to witness any sign of reasonableness on his part. Phineas better discover where they are before too much longer." Harry snorted. Snape had been right to worry, though in a moment of clarity, Harry recognised that, in all likelihood, he would have apparated away rather than be disgraced and humiliated for a second time. Snape had been too quick, too powerful for Harry to overcome when Harry had rage and justice on his side. If caught off guard, he wouldn't stand a chance. "Why the fuck did Weasley pick now to be the hero? With him out of the picture, there was a chance. One fucking chance. Place the sword in the pond, wait for Potter to act without thinking, save the impudent whelp from himself, earn back a small measure of trust and aid him. Offer him and know-it-all Granger a decent meal, deliver the message and disappear. But no, for the first time in his pointless life, Weasley has to be useful. He's a man now, and he's fucking beautiful. Too thin by half. He and Granger must be starving. Without those wretched spectacles, there's not much of James in him. Not much of Lily either. Merlin, what I wouldn't give to worship every inch of that skin. Swallow him to the root. Shag him until he no longer knows his name. Hold him close and breathe him in. Keep him safe. On those few occasions when I allow myself a moment to fantasize, why did the fucking bastard have to wear Potter's face?" Harry slammed the volume shut, hands trembling, his cheeks burning. "Get out of my head, you slimy git," he snarled in a low voice. He growled as he tugged at his hair, blaming hormones for the heat pooling low in his belly, for the sudden throbbing of his prick. That night, I wrote a long, chatty letter to Ginny, filled with details about his struggles with aura training and passing along the rumours he and Ron had overheard whilst at the ministry. He ignored Ron's long, drawn-out sigh. He knew what he was doing, and he wasn't going to let Snape keep him from having the things he really wanted, no matter how fascinating Harry found him to be. Voldemort began to summon Snape regularly to Malfoy Manor not long after the fiasco at Godric's Hollow, sending him back to Hogwarts with orders to torture more Gryffindors for information. Dumbledore's army resisted, enabling Snape to trot out various memories. Neville with a broken nose, Ginny with a blackened eye hissing her defiance, to give the appearance of compliance. It was only good fortune, or an act of providence, that kept Snape from crossing paths with Harry and company when they'd been captured by the Snatchers, so frequent were his visits to Malfoy Manor becoming. The tightrope Snape walked grew thinner and thinner until it was no wider than the edge of a scalpel, and he was under strict orders to report every mention of Harry Potter at his earliest opportunity, no matter how innocuous the reference might be. And still Snape prepared, travelling regularly to who know where with the house elf he'd pressed into service, consulting Dumbledore's portrait a dozen times a day, yelling at Phineas to find that wretched boy so he could deliver the final message. He had, Harry learnt, even practised withdrawing memories wandlessly, since he knew Harry was an unmitigated disaster at the mental disciplines. At the end, Snape worried that he'd played his cards too close to the vest. Neither Phineas nor Minerva trusted him. Dumbledore refused to tell him whether anyone else had been tasked with delivering the message to Potter if Snape was unable to complete his final mission. The strain was taking its toll. His handwriting, never very good to begin with, grew spikier, more illegible, and Harry found himself struggling to decipher the words. "The boy's Patronus has been seen in Hogsmeade. He is coming. I can only hope he is every bit as hot-headed now as he was a year ago. I need his anger if this is going to work. How else would I find the courage to send him to his death?" By the time he reached the last page of Snape's journal, Harry was more Snape's man than Dumbledore's, and his loyalty to Dumbledore remained undiminished. Through his efforts, he would see to it that Snape received every accolade to which he was entitled. It was the very least Snape deserved. "I didn't die," Harry whispered to the swiftly scrawled words. "I lived. And I suspect you did as well." He trailed his fingers over the page, the heavy paper smooth under his fingertips. "I wish I could thank..." Harry's eyes widened as more words appeared on the page. "Potter, spare me from your mawkish sentimentality. The purpose in giving you my journals was not to engender any sympathy, nor try to humanise myself in your eyes. I am quite beyond giving a damn what you or anyone else thinks of me. I promised you knowledge of your mother, and I have given you that. It appears we are indebted to each other, and no matter how many times I attempt to clear the life debt owed to your father, I somehow manage to earn another in its place. If you lack understanding, consider asking Trelawney to read the portents to determine exactly what I mean. I've accepted that I will be forever tied to you, no doubt in payment of some cosmic debt that will require several lifetimes to fulfil. I know you have read the diaries, and, unless I have no understanding of you whatsoever, you are already planning to seek me out. Do not come looking for me. You are not ready. I require you to live first. And you have not done that, not yet. At this point you have done little more than survive, to live up to the expectations placed upon your shoulders by the acts of a madman when you are far too young to truly comprehend them. When you know who you are, when you are Harry, not Harry Potter, not the boy who lived, when you are honest with yourself, and comfortable in your skin, find me. Find me then, Harry, and become the man you are meant to be. Severus Snape. P.S. Don't bother Trelawney. It is one of your very few saving graces that you cannot abide her either. It was the Dittany that saved me, you fool. P.P.S. It is the 12th of March 1999 as I write this, and it is charmed to appear 30 minutes after you opened this page. The headline of today's Daily Prophet indicates the Weird Sisters have disbanded. However will we survive? Stunned. Elated. Harry read the entry 3 times and then once more for good measure. The Greasy Git had survived. Snape was still alive and he wanted Harry to find him. Scrabbling through his desk, he found parchment and quill and began to write out the steps he'd need to follow in order to find Snape. He would start with Snape's vault at Gringotts. Then he'd go to the house at Spinner's End. He'd read the diaries again, this time with an eye towards finding where Snape was hiding, and find the house elf Snape had conscripted. Creature should be able to help with that. First things first. Hermione and Ginny were sitting their NEWTs in about 6 weeks. Harry and Ron had 3 more months of aura training to survive, and then Ron and Hermione would be getting married. Ginny was trying out with several Quidditch teams as chaser, which left Harry free to, well, free to live. But after he'd survived his first year in the aura office, after he'd lived a little as Snape required, after that, then Harry would go hunting. The end. This story was written by A Secret Chord for the 2013 Snarryathon and recorded by Jocunda Sykes in September and October 2021 for the House of Snarry Oktoberfest. I hope you enjoyed it, and it would be lovely to hear from you.